rise in the 60s.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A U.S. military helicopter was shot down by hostile forces in western Iraq today. According to U.S. Central Command, the two members of the crew ejected safely and the attackers were killed. In northern Iraq, U.S. forces launched a major campaign, Operation Peninsula Strike, apprehending almost 400 suspected Saddam loyalists this week in the town of Thuluia, described as a stronghold of Hussein's Ba'athist party. A U.S. official said that at least three Iraqis died in that roundup. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad is Daniel Williams of The Washington Post. Daniel, U.S. officials are calling Operation Peninsula Strike the biggest since the end of the Iraqi war. Who was targeted and why?
Well, it is the biggest. Whether it's the biggest success, we don't know exactly. They were targeting Ba'ath Party officials probably connected with security services. But how many of the 400 that they collected fit that bill is hard to say. So they collected some children among them, some elderly people, of which about 60 have been released. How many are still in custody is a mystery.
Well, now, Iraqi civilians have actually been complaining about the way the operation was undertaken. Have you heard any of these complaints?
Well, there were some killings. The Army doesn't, U.S. Army doesn't talk too much about them. Apparently a 15-year-old boy was killed as well, thinking that the intruders were thieves, and he grabbed the gun and the soldier shot him. So, you know, it was nighttime. It was all evidently a very frightening affair, so it's not surprising, even though it may be shocking, that these things happen.
What was the reason that the U.S. decided to even launch the operation?
Well, they say they got intelligence information that there were Fedayeen Saddam militia fugitives, that this place is a hotbed of loyalty to Saddam Hussein. They've been apparently planning it for some time. So there had been attacks on American troops in this area over a period of weeks, and they decided to strike back.
Tell us about the area and the town that's been described as the most dangerous place in Iraq by U.S. officials. Why? What is it like?
Well, they hadn't been there very much, so I think they do that by extrapolating the idea that there's many Ba'athists and Saddam loyalists there. It's a wooded place, lots of date palms, very steamy, and somewhat hostile, I think, to the American presence.
Yeah. Do you have any sense, given that these are accused of being Ba'athist loyalists, is there any sense that Saddam Hussein might still be in the area?
Well, I have not heard anyone tell me who was detained that they were asked about Saddam Hussein. They were asked about other people, but not him. So if they were looking for him, they didn't do it through interrogation, as far as I know.
And then who were they asked about?
Well, the one major one was a guy named Ali Majid Hussein, who, known as Chemical Ali, the man notorious for using chemical weapons on Kurds in northern Iraq. He was at one point thought to be dead, killed in the south of Iraq, but now the Americans are looking for him, and they thought he might be there.
Yeah. Well, Daniel, thank you. As you seem to well know from your position, the war is not over.
Well, today that's what they said. It's still a combat zone.
Yeah.
Daniel, especially central Iraq.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Williams is a reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke to us from Baghdad.
American customs inspectors will soon be working side by side with their foreign counterparts at major seaports in Muslim countries and at other smaller foreign ports. The inspectors will be looking for weapons of mass destruction hidden in cargo ships. To ask why this is happening and why now, we turn to Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and an expert on defense and security. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Michael, why now? Why has the United States decided to do this now?
Well, I think the other way to look at the question is why wait? And in fact, we're now a year and a half after 9/11. We know that al-Qaeda is very resourceful and entrepreneurial in what kinds of tactics it will use against us. I think this is a good idea. If anything, it's overdue. And if anything, it's not being pursued with enough seriousness because we don't have enough people and resources behind it.
So far as you know, no specific warning out there, no chatter, as they call it?
Well, there have been indications that there is some reason to think al-Qaeda may work through a couple of countries that are on this new list, that it may have contacts in those countries and also even perhaps an interest in using their ports. And in broader terms, I don't think we should wait to hear chatter. That approach would not have prevented 9/11, and frankly, Al-Qaeda is too resourceful to just wait for a sloppy mistake or a slip-up or an overheard conversation.
Well, sure. I mean, it was just weeks after September 11th when authorities in Italy discovered an Egyptian man suspected of Al-Qaeda membership hiding in a shipping container bound for Nova Scotia. This man apparently disappeared while on bail.
Right.
How vulnerable are these foreign ports? Which are most vulnerable?
I don't know if I would even try to answer that second question. I'm not sure I'm smart enough. I'm not sure any of us really are. I think that there certainly are countries, and some of the ones that are on this recent list, Malaysia, what have you, some of the Gulf countries may be particularly of concern. We know that Southeast Asia, the Persian Gulf, tend to be the regions where Al-Qaeda is most firmly ensconced right now with the most contacts, and so it makes sense to go to those places as well as the large ports in East Asia and Europe where the greatest volume of shipping is conducted.
Now, how many inspectors will we be sending?
My understanding is that this will be in the dozens, but the main point here is that this is a small number of people working often in teams of four and five and six individuals once they're on the job, who, as much as anything, are really advising the overseas ports on how to improve their own security and doing the very occasional spot check.
Well, in this country, it's still only some 2% of containers that are checked, correct?
That's correct. At least I have not seen any hard data that is a higher number than that. I have never heard the U.S. government give a precise figure, however. I think the U.S. government doesn't want us to know in some ways just how far we still have to go.
So would that 2, 3, 4%, do you think, approximate how many containers are checked in foreign ports?
Yes, I think that's probably a safe assumption. If anything, the numbers are likely to be lower overseas.
So 98%, whether we send a few dozen people overseas or not, 95% or so of containers in foreign ports still won't be checked.
That's probably right. Now, it may be feasible to do a little better than that, because if you're actually inspecting while containers are being loaded, it can sometimes be easier. You don't have to worry about unpacking the container or sort of fitting your way into a tight vessel. But nonetheless, you're talking about a few percent of total global cargo being inspected, and that's probably an upper bound.
Still sounds like pretty good odds for a terrorist.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And so therefore, I commend the Department of Homeland Security for this idea, but I hope that we also keep pushing, broaden the geographic scope, and even more so intensify the level of effort in the places where we have now sent inspectors.
Michael O'Hanlon, thanks a lot for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Well, U.S. diplomats are expected to take the heat at the U.N. today for the Bush administration's stance on the International Criminal Court. The court was established last year to prosecute crimes against humanity, but President Bush backed away from the treaty, saying the court would prompt political witch hunts. And the U.S. won a one-year exemption from prosecution for U.S. citizens involved in U.N. peacekeeping missions. The Security Council is expected to pass another year-long exemption today, but not without debate and dissent. Joining us on the line is retired Canadian Major General Lewis McKenzie, who served on 9 U.N. peacekeeping missions. Welcome, Major General.
Yeah, hi, Ron.
Hi. Organizations such as Amnesty International, the Human Rights Watch, and several countries have been critical of this push for an extension and an exemption from prosecution for people such as yourselves. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not surprised they feel that way, but when you've been stuck in the middle of it, I'm very sympathetic with the American desire to have not only an extension, but an exemption forever. And quite frankly, it's based on my own personal experience. I was the commander in Sarajevo in 1992 at the beginning of the Bosnian War, and when I came out, I was invited to appear in front of the U.S. Congress and gave evidence recommending that, in actual fact, America not get involved in peacekeeping in Bosnia, which is exactly what the Bosnian government wanted. Within about 24 hours, I was accused of raping and murdering a bunch of young Muslim girls in Sarajevo, cutting their throats and leaving their bodies in front of my headquarters. And I think I was supposed to have done that on the 15th of August. I'd left the theater on the 31st of July. But nevertheless, it's just an example of politically motivated accusations. There's still a warrant out for my arrest in Sarajevo, to the best of my knowledge, so I obviously don't go back and visit there.
Well, your story is the fear of the U.S. government, but according to the wording of the resolution, American U.N. peacekeepers would be exempt if Washington guarantees that charges against them would be investigated and brought to trial in the U.S. So presumably, if you were an American, you would have been found innocent, and you would never have gone to the international court.
That is absolutely a possibility. However, having been accused of something like that and not having it resolved, then obviously has a severe impact on your reputation in certain countries around the world, in this case, particularly Islamic countries. Mm. So I can see very much why the Americans would want an exemption.
Well, Major General, in just the few seconds we have left, do you worry at all that this exemption and is a green light for the, if you will, bad soldiers?
No. Well-disciplined professional armies do a pretty darn good job of policing their own. It's not a closed society as perceived by society where, in actual fact, people can get away with murder. I mean, we're talking about war crimes here. We're talking about genocide, murder, mutilation, torture. And professional militaries and their parent countries and their parent governments handle that extremely well, thank you very much. The fact that the UN's credibility is suffering pretty seriously these days is not the type of organization that I would want being responsible for dealing with your senior commanders in those particular circumstances.
Well, Major General, we thank you very much, and we should just add that the vote is expected to pass, so the debate will just be that. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Canadian Major General Lewis McKenzie, who served on 9 UN peacekeeping missions. David Brinkley died today, most recently seen on ABC TV as host of the Sunday morning show This Week with David Brinkley. He was also a fixture at the anchor desk at NBC, paired with Chet Huntley for 14 years. He was a towering figure at NBC. As a young correspondent, I once encountered David Brinkley in the elevator and sputtered out how much I admired his clipped delivery, his no-nonsense approach, his fairness and balance, to which he replied, "Young lady, the only thing without an opinion in a newscast is the typewriter." Here is David Brinkley being interviewed by his son Alan in the 1990s at an event sponsored by the Smithsonian, talking about how he got his start in journalism.
Alan, to get to your question, I got started out of Wilmington, North Carolina, because the county librarian, Miss Emma Woodward, God rest her soul, who tutored me, she saw me in the public library almost every day, seemingly trying to read every book in the place. She called my mother and said I needed more than high school was giving me, so she would take me over and tutor me. And she did. And finally, I learned a little something. And I got a job on the local newspaper, which is really what got me started into journalism. I haven't done anything else. I've done any other kind of work since then. And don't anticipate ever doing any other kind of work. And I probably couldn't do any other kind of work if I tried it.
David Brinkley. He died today at the age of 82 after a fall at his home in Houston.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Landry and Arcari Oriental Rugs and Carpeting, offering a complimentary brochure filled with pictures and tips on buying rugs and carpeting. 800-649-5909. M. Steinert & Son, serving the needs of New England's piano lovers since 1860. Locations in Boston, Natick, and Worcester. Massachusetts' only authorized Steinway dealer. msteinert.com. And Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event. Catering menus are available at 617-666-4366. 64 degrees in Boston right now, 66 light rain at Chatham. The time is 12:20.
Wondering what to get your dad for Father's Day?
I'm sure a lot of dads would be thrilled to get a Car Talk necktie.
Well, I know I would be.
Thrill your dad this Father's Day with a special tie from Car Talk. A $100 contribution for the news will get a silk Car Talk tie delivered in time for Father's Day. Order before tomorrow morning's 10 o'clock deadline at WBUR.org or call 800-909-9287.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Even though Japan has one of the best equipped armies in the world, that word, army, is hardly ever used in Japan to describe it. To a nation traumatized after World War II and two atomic bombs, army sounded too militaristic. The force is 250,000 soldiers and sailors and pilots strong, but it is a national defense force, able to act only if attacked. And even then, only under a near bizarre labyrinth of restrictions, like troop convoys rushing to confront an attack, having to stop at red lights. Well, last week, new legislation removed many of those restrictions, and seemingly reasonable as the changes may be, they've made some in both Japan and throughout Asia very nervous. Joining us to discuss this is Paul Giara, a Japan security analyst and former Japan desk officer at the Pentagon. He joins us from Virginia. Welcome, Paul.
Nice to be here, Bill.
Thanks for joining us, Paul. And Mindy Kotler, director of the Japan Information Access Project. She joins us from Washington. And welcome, Mindy.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Giara, to start with you, how important are these changes? How significant?
I'm not quite sure what there is to compare it to, but this is the United States feeling its way into the world in the early 1900s with Teddy Roosevelt and the Great White Fleet. It's the United States between 1914 and 1917 deciding whether to take part and so on. And it's this the consequences of these changes are really profound. They're not only profound for Japan, they're profound for the region. But more to the point, from my perspective, especially with my background working on the Japan desk in the Pentagon, is profound for the U.S.-Japan security relationship and American interests.
Well, Mindy, let's talk about what has the Japan Army, if that's even the correct way to say it, been since World War II?
Well, first thing, you can't call it an army. It's very dangerous to refer to it as an army or as a military in Japanese political circles until quite recently, mm-hmm. and it is not even officially called a defense ministry. It's a defense agency, so it's a ministry for self-defense. It's the self-defense forces. They've been there to defend Japan if attacked, no more, and not to go beyond its borders.
Now, Mindy, what's changed in the past few weeks of legislatively?
Well, a number of issues, most important, the Japanese had very much restrained themselves on what they could or could not do within the country. There was not an ability to declare a martial law and then what rules and regulations the Japanese self-defense forces could follow or not follow, such as whether they should be stopping at traffic lights on the way to the battlefield or not, whether they can go through somebody's rice paddy, and what are the duties and obligations. It was such a bitter experience during the 1930s and during the war in Japan to have this kind of martial law to reenact any kind of emergency legislation, as it is called, has been a politically a very contentious and difficult issue. And so there now are some laws in the books on what will happen if there is a state of emergency and what the self-defense forces can and cannot do.
So, but still, Paul, these are pretty nuanced changes in what the Japanese Defense Force can do, right? Why is it seemingly causing so much concern among Japanese?
Well, it's not causing concern just among Japanese. I think most of Asia anticipates and understands the differences because Japan has been taken for granted as a peaceful and non-externally oriented nation in terms of security since really the end of the war, and that's what the issue is now, is how is that going to change and what's that going to mean?
Well, Paul, speaking of the neighborhood, part of the neighborhood is North Korea, right? Really, really close by. Shouldn't Japan be concerned about North Korea and perhaps begin to shift some of its military posturing from what it used to be?
Well, that's correct. The North Koreans really are a problem for everybody, and in particular for the Japanese, because I think the North Koreans understand that probably the single greatest difficulty they can provide for us is to attack the Japanese and split our alliance rather than attacking to the south. So this is a real conundrum for the Japanese. In the past, the United States has said that we would take care of this, but it's very hard to defend against missiles. So the issue for one of the key issues for the alliance is going to be missile defense.
So is this about Japan being more worried about things that are going on in its neighborhood or about Japan, as so many seem to fear, becoming more nationalist, which so many assume, particularly in Asia, means they will become more militant, more militarist?
I think it's the former. I see very little prospect for the Japanese to be militant or militaristic.
Mindy?
Well, I agree with Paul. In the past, the Japanese have, to borrow a Chinese phrase, been binding their feet to prevent their progress intentionally. That's not the future.
Hmm. And the future could be, Paul, a Japan that, while the U.S. wants it to be more kind of on its own feet from a defense perspective, a Japan that might conceivably be a little more on its own feet than the United States might want.
Right. I think the choice is whether this is the Great Britain of Asia or the France of Asia. And I think those are quite a stark difference. And
you said it.
And probably the most important part of this, what this legislation represents, besides the technical changes on enabling the self-defense forces to do what any practical National Guard would do, is that it shows a willingness to finally to grapple with these issues, to discuss them publicly, to debate them, and to move forward as a country to discuss security issues without the assumption that the United States will come to their defense.
Hmm.
Bill, I think there's a lot of counterintuitive potential here. One of the issues might be, for instance, an outcome in which Japan is much stronger militarily because it can actually use its military for something besides the strict defense of Japan, but is essentially less secure because of the response in the region. This is the kind of thing that the U.S. has got to take into account. You know, what are we going to get at the end of the day?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Japanese culture is good at subtlety, and here subtle shifts in its military seem to be dramatically reverberating throughout Asia. And I want to thank you both for joining us to try to pick it apart a bit.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
Paul Giara is a Japan security analyst. Mindy Kotler is director of the Japan Information Access Project.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new documentary goes behind the scenes at the high-pressured, nail-biting National Spelling Bee competition.
That's TOMORROW.
2 hours, 1 hour. Okay, stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Stonehenge Neckwear, makers of 100% silk ties with classic patterns designed to embody the idea of enduring excellence, available at local retailers. The time is 12:29.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack the Tappan Brothers.
And there are certain times when the importance of WBUR really hits home.
Yeah, for me, it's when I'm going to a ball game and I need a free place to park on Calm Ave. I use the WBUR a lot. That's when I say to myself, boy, am I glad WBUR is here.
Well, I was referring exactly to WBUR's primary mission, you knucklehead, helping people understand what's going on in the world.
Ah, I gotcha. There are times when events are so crazy that it's hard to get your head around them.
And that's when WBUR really proves itself with careful journalism, calm, smart reporters, and thoughtful analysts.
And all of that costs money.
And you know that's where we're heading with this, right?
You probably know that WBUR is offering to send a Car Talk necktie to your favorite dad for Father's Day this year.
And it happens to be a pretty cool necktie, if I do say so myself. And rest assured, my brother and I had nothing to do with designing it.
But we want you to remember that it's not a necktie that you're buying. It's great programming that you're investing in.
So order a tie, give your dad a laugh, but don't forget that the small fortune that WBUR skims off every one of these ties goes to keeping you informed. So order yours now.
Just make a $100 pledge at 800-909-9287, or you can do it online at WBUR.org.
Thanks.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, coming up, the monkeypox scare. We'll examine the risks and benefits of using the smallpox vaccine to contain the outbreak.
Also, they say if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. Well, they're still waiting in the Northeast and out West. We'll get a rain check from the Farmer's Almanac on the wet and dry spring weather.
And musician and activist Bruce Cockburn will play from his new CD and talk about, you know, where he's at.
Where I am is where I have to be. And that's about as much of it as I understand.
Heavy. These stories coming up here and now.
Good afternoon. I'm Dolores Handy. Iraqi forces shot down a U.S. helicopter gunship in western Iraq today. The two crew members of the U.S. Army Apache attack helicopter ejected and are okay. A spokesman at Central Command says U.S. troops have killed those who fired at the chopper. This is the first time a military aircraft has been brought down by ground fire since the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime. At least seven people were killed during an Israeli missile strike in Gaza City today. The victims included a member of the Hamas Islamic Organization's military wing, as well as his wife and their two small children. The car had been moving through a Gaza City neighborhood when witnesses say it was hit by three missiles. This is the third consecutive day of Israeli strikes against Hamas targets. Some space program experts say NASA has not learned from the mistakes of the past, and the space agency should not get more money from the federal government. The experts are testifying in Washington today before a special panel investigating the Shuttle Columbia disaster. One expert says even though NASA's budget has declined over the past decade, that might not have directly contributed to the Columbia accident. The Senate is calling for a comprehensive inventory of offshore oil and gas resources. However, some are concerned that such a study could lead to a lifting of the 20-year-old ban on drilling beneath most of America's coastal waters. Wisconsin health officials are checking into what may be the first human-to-human transmission of monkeypox in America. A healthcare worker there may have contracted the disease from a patient. A monkeypox outbreak in people has been linked to pet prairie dogs, and authorities are checking in 15 states for infected prairie dogs.
Good night, Chet.
Good night, David, and good night for NBC News.
David Brinkley, who first gained fame as one half of NBC's Huntley Brinkley anchor team, has died. During his 50-year career, Brinkley won 10 Emmy Awards, 3 Peabody Awards, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Brinkley hosted ABC's This Week from 1981 until 1996, when he resigned after calling President Clinton a bore.
On this, my last word here on ABC, I quote Shakespeare, who said, "All's well that ends well." My time here now ends extremely well. Thank you.
David Brinkley was 82 years old. This is Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Shore Magnetic Imaging Center, providing MRI services for over 15 years. Locations in Peabody, Beverly, and Salem. Information at 800-540-8960. Surface Works of Watertown and Concord, a professional cleaning service, because it's nice to come home to a clean house. 617-926-7633. And TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. Tim Wakefield will be on the mound tonight for the Red Sox in the final game of their 3-game interleague series against the Cardinals at Fenway Park. The Sox won last night's game 13-1 to move back into first place in the American League East. Forecast, cloudy this afternoon. The chance of sprinkles late this afternoon. High 70 to 75. Rain tonight and tomorrow. Tomorrow's highs in the 60s. It's 12:34.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta is recommending smallpox vaccines for some Americans. But this time, the warning has nothing to do with terrorism. It has to do with prairie dogs and Gambian rats. The announcement comes after 50 people in 4 states showed symptoms of the monkeypox virus, a disease that usually occurs in Central and West Africa. The virus spreaders in this country are apparently the aforementioned prairie dogs, kept by some as pets, who in turn may have caught the disease from another new exotic pet, the lovable Gambian rat. Well, joining us now to discuss why smallpox vaccine is Lewis Cooper, interim director of the National Network for Immunization Information and a professor of pediatrics at Columbia University. Welcome, doctor.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Doctor, why smallpox vaccine for monkeypox virus?
Smallpox, the disease, and monkeypox, the disease, are both caused by viruses that belong to the same family. And it so happens that the vaccine we use against smallpox, vaccinia, protects or provokes antibody that is protective against both smallpox and monkeypox.
Now, how dangerous, how lethal, I guess, is what I'm asking, is monkeypox virus?
We have no experience in the Western Hemisphere, but in Africa, the mortality ranges between 1 and 10%. And clearly those are numbers that we don't want to have to face in this country.
Now, smallpox vaccines have some danger in them too, right?
Sure, and that's why we were glad years ago when we didn't have to use this vaccine anymore. But always we're balancing risk and benefit. And quite clearly, the smallpox vaccine that we used to give to every American does not carry a mortality rate of 1 to 10%. So that's why, in terms of trade-offs, we're far better off offering smallpox vaccine to persons who are really exposed to monkeypox than allowing them to go ahead and get this disease.
Well, remind us how risky a smallpox vaccine can be.
Remember, smallpox vaccine was given to every American child between ages 1 and 2. Though one in several thousand or up to 100,000 for some complications was at risk, it was worth doing when smallpox was a risk. In no way do those numbers approach the kind of numbers that we see with monkeypox, at least in the African population.
Still, it's quite a step when we start talking about vaccinating people for smallpox, for monkeypox virus in this case. How concerned would you be that this outbreak could become more epidemic?
We don't have any clue as to what the risks are. And so the CDC, using the best advice it could get from people around the country, said better to get on top of this early rather than find out late. Combating a new infection is a little like dealing with a fire. If you have a small brush fire, you don't wait until it becomes a major forest fire before you attempt to control it. And that's what they're trying to do, is sit on it while it's still easily contained.
Very briefly, Doctor, what would you say to anyone who's made the move to keeping a prairie dog in the house, let alone a Gambian rat?
I don't understand it. We've got some great domestic pets. My house has two dogs in it, and hard for me to understand, even though they're cute.
Dr. Lewis Cooper, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Lewis Cooper is with the National Network for Immunization Information and professor of pediatrics at Columbia University.
It is another gloomy, overcast, miserable day in Boston. And as if the rainy spring in the East isn't enough, we now face summer and mosquitoes. The thirsty thieves are continuing to hatch in spots of water that would normally be dried up by now. Meanwhile, the West is wondering when their drought is going to end, a drought which attracts a different kind of mosquito. Well, joining us on the line now is Sandy Duncan. She's managing editor at the Farmer's Almanac in Lewiston, Maine. And Sandy, is this the spring that you predicted?
Unfortunately, it is. According to the Farmer's Almanac, we had predicted a very rainy spring in the Northeast.
Right. And as I said, the West also it has a drought to contend with, but we've learned that there's a mosquito that they have to be concerned with out there. And, of course, the big concern is that mosquitoes spread diseases like West Nile and equine encephalitis. And so there's a lot of concern going into summer.
Yes, unfortunately. I think the weather is always a hot topic, but this year especially, and we had kind of predicted that it would be somewhat drier out in the Northwest and the West.
Yeah. Well, what do you see for the future since you do a year at a time?
Sure. Well, in the Northeast, we had predicted a showery weather with the characteristics of the spring. And for the summer, we said that it would probably be hot and humid. However, unfortunately, there's going to be some major fronts that come through that have a greater than normal amount of severe weather, which would be thunderstorms, damaging wind, hail, and tornadoes.
Some people might say, you know, no duh, you know, hot and humid in the summer. But you spoke of the tornadoes and the heavy weather fronts. What else are you seeing that's different from, you know, a normal prediction for summer weather?
Well, it does look like the normal, we do have the hot and humid predictions in there, but according to the Farmer's Almanac, we're also calling for a variety of sharp cold fronts, both in mid-June and in mid-July in the Northeast. And if you follow our forecast, you could see that, you know, but for 3 days at a time, we do predict what it might be. But it does, unfortunately, look like it's going to be a little more rainy and showery in this summer than it has been in the past.
What about out west?
Out west, it doesn't look like they're going to have any relief until probably the autumn, starting in September and October, and that looks like when finally the rain starts coming down for them.
Wow. Farmer's Almanac also offers wisdom learned over the ages. Do you have any to share with us about bugs?
Well, one is an interesting one, is if the mosquitoes are biting, you might want to try some vapor rub, the stuff you usually use when you have a cold, and that's supposed to repel the mosquitoes, and I've used it myself, and it works pretty well.
You mean like, I hate to use a product, but Vicks Vapor Rub, the kind
yeah.
of thing you put, huh?
Yes, put a little bit on that. They don't seem to like that. And supposedly if you prick an orange and kind of rub that on some part of your body, they don't particularly like the sour smell of those types of vegetable or fruits. And another thing is if you get bit by a mosquito, you might want to try some meat tenderizer. That helps take the itch right away.
And if none of them work, you will have, let's see, bees. And with the meat tenderizer, I don't know.
Actually, meat tenderizer works really well. If you get stung by something or bit by something, it helps take the sting away. And it also helps take the itch away. Just put a little paste on where you got bit. And stay inside for a little bit so the bees and everything else don't get you. But you don't have to stay in for long.
Well, and if you use the Vicks Vapor Rub, you'll keep everybody away.
That's right.
Sandy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sandy Duncan, managing editor of the Farmer's Almanac, based in Lewiston, Maine. What a cold and rainy day.
Well, on earth is the sun in a way. Still to come, singer Bruce Cockburn still going strong with album number 27.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Sometimes we get reading suggestions from listeners, and this one came our way from Jay Jose, who heard our story about Palestinians attempting to rebuild their homes without permits. He writes, "For a better understanding of why people in underdeveloped regions build without permits, read The Mystery of Capital by Hernando de Soto. He argues it's the legal system that's flawed, not the construction."
That's funny. I happen to have that book on my desk. I'll get right to it. Well, we got a lot of response to yesterday's story about the young boy in Colombia who innocently agreed to carry a package for a FARC guerrilla fighter. The package blew up and killed the boy. A listener named David wrote, "That story tore my heart out. I have an 8-year-old son and couldn't help thinking he may have done the same thing. I was moved to tears."
Sean Donahue of Lawrence, Massachusetts also reacted to the story, but with some criticism.
"I have traveled to Colombia twice on human rights delegations and are preparing to travel there for a third time. And the story about the death of a 10-year-old child was heartbreaking. Yet where's the coverage when union organizers and indigenous leaders are killed on a daily basis by right-wing paramilitaries linked to the Colombian military? And where is the coverage when entire villages are massacred by those same paramilitaries in order to gain access to land? Please tell the whole story about the war in Colombia."
Well, switching gears, our literary critic Steve Almond talked about new and noteworthy historical fiction. Deborah in Cambridge writes, "I'm heading down to Harvard Square right now to try to buy all the books you mentioned. Now I just have to figure out how to deal with the financial emergency of this rash act. But hey, books are still the cheapest, I mean least expensive, entertainment you can buy."
Russell Robeson of Brookline, Massachusetts, saw the connection between one of our cooking segments and our story on declining fish stocks. He writes, "Many of the varieties of seafood you used when you cooked with kebabs are those in peril, namely swordfish and some varieties of tuna and scallops. The recipe on the show sounded great, but I try to avoid eating these varieties right now. The Monterey Bay Aquarium website has more information about this issue, including a pocket guide on making responsible choices when purchasing seafood."
This correction came our way after our story on the horses of Central Park. Bonnie writes about the picture on our website. "You made a teeny mistake about a huge horse. Milky Way is a Claremont hack horse. The Parks Department horse in the picture is named Jock.
Of course, of course. And finally, listeners wanted to know who wrote the piano piece identified as the second movement of the B minor sonata in Ellen Pfeiffer's classical music piece. Well, it was Franz Liszt's Sonata in B Minor, performed by the Slovenian pianist Dubravka Tomzik from the CD A Liszt Recital. And here's some more from that piece.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name. We need the whole name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Hill, a Greater Boston Life Care retirement community in Needham, offering independent living apartments, home health, skilled nursing, and rehabilitation for 18 years. 781-433-6520. Nextel, offering Nextel Direct Connect, the digital walkie-talkie feature in all Nextel phones that lets one get right through with the push of a button. Nextel, how business gets done. Nextel.com. And the Catered Affair, since 1979, creating chef-inspired cuisine for intimate dinner parties to festive galas in Greater New England. Information on the web at thecateredaffair.com. The WBUR online auction continues through tomorrow. We'd like to thank TechFusion.com, the Interaction Institute for Social Change, and NetPudding.com for their contributions. There's still a wide selection of items you can bid on, so go to WBUR.org and make a bid for the news. It's 1248.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Canadian-born Bruce Cockburn has been making music for over 30 years. He's prolific. His new album is his 27th, and he's often political. One recent project was the Concert for a Landmine-Free World. Well, Cockburn's new release is called You've Never Seen Everything, songs written over the last 3 years, including this one, Tried and Tested. From Bruce Cockburn's new CD, You've Never Seen Everything. And Bruce Cockburn is here in the studio to talk about the new release. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I tried to listen to the lyrics. Tried and tested by the cries of birds, lies I've heard, my own guitar, the way I walk, by the cause of peace, the laws of priests, by the glutton's feast, by the word police.
You're close.
Close?
Yeah, there's a lot of rhyming stuff in there.
Well, it just reminded me, in listening to it, it has been a rough year.
Well, it's been a rough year for lots of people, and the content of my songs is generally pretty subjective, even when it does include what people think of as the political. I mean, because it's art, it's about my reaction to the things that I'm confronted by. So, you know, Tried and Tested, I don't think of that as a political song particularly, although there are many references in it to things that are out there.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because activist songwriters such as yourself have been tried and tested by the war. I mean, you signed a petition in Canada to ask that government not to participate in the war in Iraq at the time with the given evidence. You're part of so many other different causes. Is there a point where it tries and tests you?
Well, I think anything that you hold in your heart that's of value that becomes a contentious issue among people is going to try you in some way. But usually I find that people are willing to hear those points of view, and even if they don't agree with them, and it's a subtle thing, perhaps, but it's part of being Canadian, is that we expect to disagree with each other.
And nobody has steamrolled your CDs as they did to the Dixie Chicks.
That's right, although I did actually have the honor of being blacklisted by the Alberta Beef Producers Association at one time. Me and K.D. Lang, actually, I couldn't quite figure out why I was on the list, except that there's a line in a song of mine called If a Tree Falls that refers to this burning down of rainforests to make cattle pasture. And the beef growers, I guess, took exception to that line in that song. I mean, I've had my little taste of what that's like. But
you also sing on this new CD, which is just so beautifully produced, that it just also resonates with hope and joy. Let's hear a little of the new single, Open.
I never lived with balance. Sideways, I hold my breath forever. I never lived with balance, though I've always liked the notion. I feel an endless hunger for energy and motion.
Open on Bruce Coburn's new CD, You've Never Seen Everything. It makes me wonder, how would you categorize where you are in life right now?
Well, I'm past the midlife crisis part.
Can I stop you there? Because I was going to say, you've written one of the great midlife crisis songs of all time, which is Pace in the Cage.
Yeah, I guess that is that, isn't it?
Today these eyes scan bleached out land for the coming of the outbound stage. Facing the cage.
Sooner or later in everybody's life, we get to a point where we just, you know, have to question all of the assumptions that we've brought with us to that point, and it becomes difficult to find meaning in things. But at this point, I don't have any difficulty finding meaning. I have the usual human difficulties getting through life, just like everybody else.
But now that you have the meaning.
Yeah, well, the meaning, I mean, I'm sure there is a meaning. I'm not always sure I know what it is. In fact, I'm usually convinced that I don't know what it is, and I think that's kind of an important point, that is the ability to have faith that the things that are happening are going somewhere, are leading towards some necessary end, and that whether I understand it or not, it's the ability to surrender to the forward motion of things without the need to see what the goal is, that I think is one of the great products of having survived the midlife crisis.
You mentioned your faith. I want to hear a little of another cut from the new CD. It's called Put It in Your Heart. Let's listen to that for a second. In your heart. A lot of people ask me to ask you, where is your heart, where is your faith right now?
It's kind of somewhere in a world where the people who are responsible for spreading some of the greatest darkness are the ones calling themselves Christian. I have trouble calling myself a Christian in public, although I still think of myself as that.
Were you a born-again Christian?
Well, what does that mean? You know, I mean, was I a right-wing zealot masquerading as a religious person? No. I never was that. When I became a Christian, I was an adult, and I sort of tried to be a bit of a fundamentalist, I guess, because it seemed like those were the people that really knew what they were talking about. But it didn't take. I couldn't really go there, and I've ended up being much more of a searcher than someone who's found a definition for himself in pursuit of the divine, or in the attempt to surrender to the divine, is a better way to put it. And I think when you get down underneath the surface of public religion, I think a lot of faiths converge. In fact, maybe they all do.
Well, you have your guitar with you, and maybe you can tell us some things with that as well. I guess the question is, how would you sum up where you are in your life? You started to say, past the midlife crisis.
Mm, yeah.
Where are we? Where?
Well, you know, just moving forward, I think. Mm. Where I am is where I have to be, and that's about as much of it as I understand. But it's enough. For one guy, anyway. So this is, I'm just going to do a little bit of this because we don't want to take up too much time. But this is part of Messenger Wind. Paints the snow all around, rose on the roofs and the trees and the ground and the stream. In my dream, messenger wind swooping out of the sky lights each tiny speck in the human kaleidoscope with hope.
Listeners hear a little more as we go out. Bruce Coburn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bruce Coburn's new CD is called You've Never Seen Everything. It's available in stores this week. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Horse-powered sleigh at the top of the town. Sun coming up paints the snow all around with rose light. In front of the house where I'm supposed to be born, I don't think I'm ready to walk through that door just yet. One more voice in the human choir, rising like smoke from the mystical fire of the heart.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks. Information on the web at MathWorks.